This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Bullet by Mary Louise Kelly. This book is read by Cassandra Campbell. For my mother, who has always believed I could do anything, and for my father, who has worked hard his whole life to give me opportunities to try to prove her right. And what we students of history always learn is that the human being is a very complicated contraption, and that they are not good or bad, but are good and bad. And the good comes out of the bad, and the bad out of the good, and the devil take the hindmost. Robert Penn Warren, All the King's Men. You think you know people when you grow up with them, when they've been beside you your whole life. You know their voices, the curves of their hands, what makes them laugh. You know their hearts. But it turns out you don't know their thoughts. Not truly. Not in full. All people have their secrets. And not just things they keep from you, but secrets about you. Things they hope you'll never learn. You can share your home with someone. Share all the silly little details of life. Share the soap, the sugar bowl, shoes. And you would never guess. You think you know someone. Then one day you find yourself running. Really running. Lungs burning, legs churning. Too frightened to stop and look back. It turns out I have been running my whole life. I just never knew it. Let me tell you what it's like to run. Let me tell you a story about fear. Part 1. Washington. 1. My name is Caroline Cashin, and I am the unlikely heroine of this story. Given all the violence to come, you were probably expecting someone different, a Lara Croft type. Young and gorgeous, sporting taut biceps and a thigh holster, right? Admit it. Yes, all right, fine, I am pretty enough. I have long dark hair and liquid chocolate eyes and hourglass hips. I see the way men stare. But there's no holster strapped to these thighs. For starters, I am 37 years old. Not old, not yet. But old enough to know better. Then there is the matter of how I spend my days. That would be in the library, studying the work of dead white men. I am an academic, a professor on Georgetown University's Faculty of Languages and Linguistics. My specialty is 19th century France, Balzac, Flaubert, Stendhal, Zola. The university is generous enough to fly me to Paris every year or so, but most of the time, you'll find me in the main campus library, glasses sliding down my nose, buried in old books. Every few hours, I'll stir, cross the quad to deliver a lecture, scold a student requesting extra time for an assignment, and then I return to my books. I read with my legs tucked beneath me in a soft blue armchair in a sunny corner of my office nook on the fourth floor. Most nights, you will also find me there, sipping tea, typing away, grading papers. Are you getting a sense for the rhythm of my days? I lead as stodgy a life as you can imagine. But it was by doing just this, by following this exact routine, that I came to schedule the medical appointment that changed everything. For months, my wrist had hurt. It began as an occasional tingling. That changed to a sharp pain that shot down my fingers. The pain got worse and worse, until my fingers turned so clumsy, my grip so weak, that I could barely carry my bags. My doctor diagnosed too much typing, too much hunching over books. To be precise, I like to be precise, he diagnosed CTS, carpal tunnel syndrome. He suggested wearing a wrist splint at night and elevating my keyboard. That helped, but not much. And so it was that I found myself one morning in the waiting room of Washington Radiology Associates. I was scheduled for an MRI to rule out arthritis and get to the bottom of what's going on, as my doctor put it. It was the morning of Wednesday, October 9th. The morning it all began. 2. Wednesday, October 9th, 2013. The waiting room for Washington Radiology was a strange place. It featured the standard doctor's office rack of well-thumbed magazines, the usual box of tissues, and oversized pump bottle of Purell. But because of the radiation in use, the door leading to the exam rooms was constructed of solid steel. A large sign read, "Danger, restricted access, strong magnetic field, serious injury may result." Just to make sure you got the point, this was accompanied by an illustration of a huge magnet surrounded by sizzling lightning bolts. Sitting there waiting to be called felt a bit like waiting to be escorted into a nuclear power plant. I leafed through a brochure. The clinic offered mammograms, ultrasounds, biopsies, and something ominously named nuclear medicine. And then there was magnetic resonance imaging, what I was here for. "Miss Cashin?" I stood up. A young woman in scrubs ushered me past the steel door and into a changing room. "Take everything off," she instructed. "It ties in front." She handed me a folded paper gown and booties, then disappeared. I began to unpeel my clothes, layers of cashmere and suede. An old boyfriend once told me I was born to wear winter clothes, that even naked I moved as though I were wearing velvet. He had a point. I dress year-round in shades of plum and tobacco and wine. Rich colors. I don't do pastels. The technician reappeared and explained how the procedure would work. I would lie back on a narrow cot, she would slide me inside the giant tube of the scanner, and then I was to stay still for 40 minutes. No squirming, no blinking. I was to resist even taking a deep breath. She handed me earplugs and a panic button in case I felt claustrophobic. No need. Getting an MRI was heavenly. What's not to like about stealing 40 minutes from a weekday morning in order to rest motionless in a warm enclosed space? The machine hummed with a loud rhythmic tapping noise. I nearly drifted off to sleep. Afterward, the technician showed me back to the changing room. She cleared her throat and stared at me. "So, we'll get those images sent over to Will Zartman. He's your regular doctor, right?" I nodded. She was still staring, naked curiosity on her face. "Was there anything else?" "No, no." She giggled shyly. I mean, how did you get it?" Her hand reached up to brush the back of her neck. "Get what?" "The, you know, here." Again, the hand reaching up. "Sorry, I'm not sure what you're talking about." "The bullet," she said. "How did you get that bullet in your neck?" Extraordinary, isn't it? How your life can change, just like that, with a few words from a stranger. Later, you look back and think, that was it. That was the moment when life cleaved into two chapters, before I knew and after. But I wasn't there yet. I was still firmly living in before. I was walking up K Street, back toward campus. A nice stroll on a crisp autumn day. It would take half an hour to get back to the library. No hurry. I didn't have class until after lunch. The encounter with the MRI technician had left me more amused than concerned, because obviously I did not have a bullet in my neck. That would require my having been shot, which had obviously never happened. It's not the kind of thing you would forget. The technician must have been inexperienced. She must have mistaken a shadow on the image, or something like that. Still, It would make for a great story one night at a dinner party. I pulled out my phone to share the news with my doctor. I liked Will Zartman. He belonged to a rare breed of physicians. He took my calls, listened carefully, and most of the time phoned in a prescription without ever making me come see him. It probably helped that I was never sick and thus rarely troubled him. Before this pain in my wrist started, I hadn't talked to him in months. Now he did his usual careful listening. Then he asked me to wait. When he returned to the line a few minutes later, he sounded thoughtful.
"I'm looking at your MRI now. They already emailed it over. There is... she's right. There is something there."
"Like a shadow, you mean?"
"No, like a... like something metal."
"There can't be.
It's lodged up against your spine. Bit tricky to make out. Did you ever have surgery on your neck or shoulders?"
"What? No."
"Things get dropped, you know. Surgical instruments, clamps, that sort of thing. The surgeon never even notices and stitches it right up. Happens occasionally. Anyway, I wouldn't worry. We'll be able to get a better idea from the X-ray."
"I need an X-ray now?" I sighed.
"Think we'd better. I'll set it up."
I thanked him and said goodbye. My wrist ached. I rubbed little circles against my inside pulse point as I walked. It was a nuisance to carve out time for another medical visit. Appointments that were supposed to last an hour could somehow expand to eat up half your day. Still, I wasn't teaching a terribly heavy course load this semester. I could find the time. And despite myself, I couldn't help but feel curious. That night, I went to my parents' house for dinner. That happens more often than it probably should, for a grown woman of 37 years. My parents and I are close. We speak every day, sometimes more than once. Most mornings, I call my mother as I potter around my kitchen, brewing a first cup of tea. We swap views on the day's headlines and whatever book we fell asleep reading the night before. You see, I live alone. I am a spinster. The word is not fashionable, but it is accurate. I'm not married. Never have been. I never found anyone I liked enough. This state of affairs is fine by me. I keep my own counsel. I am not shy. On the contrary, but I am an introvert. Few people understand the difference. Instead of a husband, I have cultivated a close circle of girlfriends. I take lovers when I feel like it. Another old-fashioned expression, I suppose, but again, accurate. And I see my parents. They live nearby in Cleveland Park, a neighborhood of wide sidewalks and genteel old houses that's home to journalists and lawyers and other members of Washington's chattering classes. My parents' house is yellow clapboard, with a shady porch and views out over the stone towers of the National Cathedral. It's the house my brothers and I grew up in, one block from the school where all three of us learned to read and write. My brothers are in their 40s now. My parents, well into their 70s. But they show no signs of wanting to downsize. I think they like watching my brother's children rampage around the house, cracking lacrosse sticks and baseball bats against the same scarred door frames that bore my brother's abuse. An upstairs bathroom counter has a burn mark from my own teenage years, when I incinerated a curling iron by cranking it to high heat before absent-mindedly sailing out the door to a sleepover party. My parents' house, in short, still feels like home. There's that, and there's the fact that I enjoy their company. But a not insignificant reason that I eat dinner there several nights a week is my mother's cooking. She cooks with flagrant disregard for cholesterol warnings or calorie counts, serving large helpings of casseroles from recipe books that went out of print in the 1970s. Tonight, she pulled from the oven a chicken pot pie. I knew from long experience that it contained both an entire bag of frozen carrot and pea medley and lashings of Crisco, and that it would taste divine. I waited until we were seated and the wine was poured before launching into my story. So you won't believe what happened at the doctor's office this morning. The strangest thing. Oh, not for your wrist again, was it? Asked my mother. Is it feeling any better? No, but they're trying to figure out what's going on, why the splint didn't help. I got an MRI this morning.
Which wrist is it again?
My father interrupted. The right. I held up my hand. But they take the MRI of your whole upper body to see where there's swelling, what's out of alignment, that type of thing. And when I got up to leave, the technician came running after me, all excited. She asked me, how crazy is this? She asked, how did you get that bullet in your neck? I paused for dramatic effect. A bullet in my neck. Can you imagine? You would have to know my father well to have noticed him flinch. His jaw tightened, the faintest flicker of a movement. I glanced at my mother. She was staring down, intently focused on her pot pie, chasing peas around the plate with her fork. They were silent, not the reaction I'd expected.
Goodness, my father managed finally. What did you say?
I gave him a strange look. I said she must be mistaken, of course. You're supposed to stay still while they scan you, but I must have twitched. Maybe that shows up as a blur or a shadow on the image. He nodded.
Right. Well, sounds like you had an adventure.
He turned to my mother.
Chicken's delicious. Pass me a bit more.
They sat chewing. That's it? I demanded. That's your reaction? I thought you two would be falling over laughing.
Well, you said yourself, the likely explanation is the technician made an error, said my father.
Darling, we're just concerned, my mother added. I don't like the idea of you being in pain. I keep hoping this whole wrist issue will go away. I sighed. So do I. And now I have to go back and get x-rayed. I'll be in a full body cast before they're through with me.
My parents exchanged a look.
That was a joke. I'm fine. My mother opened her mouth to say something, then changed her mind.
Dinner proceeded. The conversation turned to an old Brando movie they'd just watched.
But my father's hand trembled as he topped up our wine glasses. He saw me register it and pretended to lean down to pat the dog.
Old age,
he said, grimacing as he sat back up.
Senility will set in soon.
As we stood up from the table, another look passed between my mother and father. Long married couples develop a language all their own, one that requires no words to communicate. I couldn't decipher everything they were saying to each other. Just enough to know that they were choosing not to tell me something. 3. Thursday, October 10th, 2013. The x-ray was striking. Unlike my older brothers, I had been a calm child, not prone to broken bones and late-night emergency room visits. I do not ski or mountain bike or ride horses or, indeed, partake in any dangerous activity whatsoever if I can avoid it. I told you, I'm no Lara Croft. And so, aside from dental checkups and the resulting blurry images of my molars, I had never been x-rayed, never glimpsed the interior architecture of my body. I found it fascinating. The play of dark and light, shades of silver and charcoal and chalk. You could see the long forked roots of my teeth. They were outlined more sharply than in the images I'd viewed at the dentist's. This must be a superior quality machine. Farther down came the fragile curve of my neck, vertebrae stacked neatly. The soft tissue of my skin and muscles appeared as a ghostly haze. The X-ray, in its way, was lovely. It was also unambiguous. I had still not set eyes on yesterday's MRI, so I couldn't compare the two. But that MRI technician had been utterly, unassailably correct. The bullet glowed. It glowed bright white, brighter even than the metal fillings in my teeth. The denser an object, the brighter it appears on an X-ray. And the bullet was presumably made of lead. It looked about half an inch long, tapered at one end. The tip pointed down toward my shoulders. The flat end was lodged near the base of my skull. I studied the image in disbelief. It simply was not possible. Over and over I blinked, looked away, looked back, and there it still was, glowing luridly. My mind flailed through loops of Cartesian logic. That's the French scholar in me. Je pense, donc je suis. I think, therefore I am. I doubt the bullet is there, therefore it must be. No, that wasn't right. But I was too addled to figure it out. René Descartes never tried to practice philosophy with a bullet embedded dangerously close to his brain. A bullet? Good God. I was sitting on an examining table on the second floor of a medical office building on M Street. It's the same building where Dr. Zartman practices. He had called a radiologist friend and wangled a lunchtime appointment for me. Now the radiologist was glancing back and forth between me and my X-ray, illuminated on a flat-screen monitor hanging on the wall. His eyes were wide, his face lit with a mixture of excitement and horror.
You really had no idea it was there?
No.
Did you say you got an MRI already? Do you have that image with you?
No, I frowned. Dr. Zartman has it. We can ask him to...
Come to think of it, don't do that again.
What?
Don't get an MRI again. The machine's a giant magnet. That's what the M stands for. And you've got a slug of metal in your neck. Then again, lead isn't magnetic.
He cocked his head, considering.
Still, if it's an alloy, or if you've got metallic fragments...
He inspected the X-ray again.
No, not worth the risk. The bullet's right up against your spinal cord. Major blood vessels all around it. You don't want it to move.
I swallowed. The room felt as if it were closing in.
May I?
He placed his hand on my neck, prodded gently up and down.
There's no bump, no subcutaneous scar tissue that I can feel. Where was the entrance wound?
I don't know.
Maybe around here?
His fingers inched higher, kneading the base of my scalp. I said, I don't know.
I didn't know it was there in the first place. So you don't know how long it's been in there?
No idea.
I have no idea. I don't know what to say.
His eyes narrowed.
It's awfully unusual. Getting shot would seem to be a memorable event. Getting shot in the neck, especially so.
I agree. What's your point?
Just that... Forgive me. How to put this... I'm finding it hard to believe you really had no idea you've been walking around with a bullet in your neck.
I glared at him. Well, that makes two of us, then. Two of us who think that this... I rapped my fingers against the flat screen. That this here makes absolutely no sense.
Well, I don't know a damn thing about guns. Or ammunition... But that's sure as hell no surgical clip that got dropped.
Will Zartman and I were sitting side by side in his office, our eyes glued to the image of my neck on his desktop computer screen. He was youngish for a doctor, not much older than me. I didn't know him well. But I felt comforted by his reaction. He seemed as bewildered as I was, unsure whether the appropriate response was to panic and race to the emergency room, or to giggle at the absurdity of the situation.
You're saying you really didn't know it was there?
I was getting the feeling that I would be hearing this question a lot. No, I really didn't.
And you've never felt any pain, any stiffness turning your neck, any tingling?
Well, I lifted my right hand and gingerly flexed it up and down. You know about the wrist? I don't know if it's related.
No, me neither.
He turned back to the screen.
I suppose the question is going to be, do we try to remove the bullet?
I can think of all sorts of risks involved with that.
On the other hand, I can think of all sorts of risks involved with leaving it in there. Lead poisoning, for one.
He scribbled something on a notepad.
I think the next step is for you to see a neurosurgeon. Meanwhile, let me take a look.
He brushed the dark waves of hair off my neck and leaned close.
There's no scar.
I know.
And I know I already asked, but you've never had surgery? Anywhere above the waist?
No, I've never had any surgery, period. Not that I can think of.
And I'll answer what's probably your next question. No, I've never been shot either.
As your radiologist friend was kind enough to point out, that would tend to be a memorable event in one's life. Dr. Zartman took a deep breath and sat back.
I've never seen anything like it. I mean, bullets don't appear out of thin air. Somehow, this one found its way to the middle of your neck. You really don't know how.
You can keep asking. The answer is still no.
What do your parents say?
I hesitated. They don't seem to know.
He must have heard something in my voice because he looked up. What do you mean, they don't seem to know?
Well, I did mention it to them last night, that the MRI had picked up something that looked like a bullet. It seemed so ludicrous. Their reaction was, I guess it was a little strange.
How so?
I thought for a moment, trying to capture the right word. Uneasy. They seemed uneasy. But that's normal, right? I felt suddenly protective. It would be normal for parents to feel uneasy when their daughter is in pain and is forced to undergo medical tests, and then tells them she got weird results. I mean, how would your mom and dad react if you told them you might have a bullet in your neck? He nodded.
Point taken. Still, someone has to know what happened. You should talk to them again.
I drove to my parents' house filled with trepidation. The conversation I was about to have with them could go either of two ways as I saw it. It was possible, probable, surely, that they knew nothing. But this was small comfort. After all, there was a bullet in my neck. If my parents didn't know how it got there, who would? The even more disturbing possibility was that they did know something. I remembered how my dad's hand had trembled at dinner, how my mother had chased peas around her plate, refusing to meet my eyes. There could be no good news story, no happy version of how a bullet had wedged itself inside my neck. But how terrible could it be? Whatever had happened, I appeared to have suffered no lasting harm. So why would they not have dared to tell me? The only even remotely plausible explanation I could conjure up involved my brothers. Today, they're both respectably married pillars of the country club set. 6 kids between them, plus mortgages and stock portfolios and regular tea times. All the trappings of middle-class middle age. But as boys, they had been wild. To this day, our across-the-street neighbor won't speak to them. She has nursed a grudge for 35 years. That's how long it's been since they shot out her bedroom window. I was a toddler at the time, so I have no memory of the episode, but as my brothers tell it, one of our uncles had unwisely given them BB guns for Christmas. They were both rotten shots, and they had been trying to improve through target practice on a squirrel living in the magnolia tree outside their window. According to the version of the story that had descended through family lore, their aim got better. They eventually shot the squirrel and left it, supposedly as a token of contrition, on our neighbor's front door mat. Perhaps she was shrewd to have stayed out of their way all these years. But, to return to the question at hand, was it possible that they had shot me, too, back when I was too small to remember? Unlikely. If they hadn't gotten away with shooting out a neighbor's window, they would never have gotten away with shooting their sister. It would have become family legend, the kind of story that gets retold and embellished upon at wedding rehearsal dinners and 40th birthday parties. There's no way I wouldn't have known. And then there was the bullet itself. I probably knew even less than Dr. Zartman about guns and ammo. But the slug in my neck looked a lot bigger and more lethal than what you would load into a child's gun. Driving toward Cleveland Park, I kept stopping to look at it. The radiologist had emailed me a JPEG version of my X-ray. At every traffic light, I braked the car and stared at my phone. You could zoom in until the bullet filled the entire screen, then zoom back out until it was just a tiny white light nestled between slivers of gray vertebrae. It was late afternoon when I pulled into the driveway. Daylight was fading. I locked the car and entered my parents' home in my usual way, a perfunctory knock, even as I turned my key in the door. My father was sitting at the kitchen table, bent over a crossword puzzle. His beagle, Hunt, ignored me, as usual. But Dad's face brightened.
"Caroline, I was hoping you would swing by. What's a seven-letter synonym for..."
"Dad..." My voice caught. I didn't know how to ask him. Instead, I held out my phone, let him glimpse the emailed image of the X-ray. His eyes told me what I needed to know.
"Oh, sweet Jesus. Darling girl. We didn't know it was still there."
4. You're thinking that I don't seem appropriately distressed, aren't you? That a woman who has just learned she is walking around with a bullet in her neck, that she has perhaps been shot, would be a bit more hysterical. Well, here you go. Standing there in the kitchen, my father fussing over me.
"Darling, please sit down. Let me make tea."
I lost it.
"What do you mean you didn't know it was still there?" I screeched. "What did you know? Why didn't you tell me?" "We didn't. We assumed that they removed it. We never thought to ask."
"Never thought to ask who? What are you talking about?" I half picked up one of the chairs and slammed it down hard against the table.
"Dad, what are you saying?"
I am not prone to outbursts, not a volatile person. But my father's evasiveness felt more alarming than the images from the X-ray and the MRI. They had seemed unreal, like props in a strange dream from which I was surely about to wake. Whereas my father, I had come here expecting him to dismiss the whole situation as risible. I had expected to share a good laugh, then have him solve the mystery of how my X-ray had gotten mixed up with someone else's, some poor soul walking around with, cue laugh track, a bullet in her neck. Instead, he was fumbling with his phone keypad, mumbling about calling my mother.
"Dad."
He held his finger up, signaling me to wait.
"Franny, Caroline's here. Come home, please." "Yes."
He hung up.
"She'll be here in 20 minutes.
"Dad, whatever it is, please just tell me."
"You know what? To hell with tea."
He pulled two glasses from a cabinet and a bottle of scotch from beside the fridge. I don't want whiskey. I swatted the bottle away. I want you to tell me what's going on. How could you have known?
Drink, he ordered, and wrapped my fingers back around the glass. His hand shook as he poured. It'll calm you down. I'm sorry this has come as such a shock. As soon as Mom gets here, I suppose we should call your brothers, too.
Why? Was it them?
Was it who?
Martin and Tony. Is that who shot me?
He looked confused.
With their old BB guns, like the squirrel? A surprised smile passed over his face.
No, it wasn't your brothers, though, Lord help us, they probably tried.
The smile faded and his eyes turned serious again.
You really don't remember? Not anything?
What should I remember?
From when you were little.
I shook my head, waited.
We always wondered. Never wanted to ask. They told us to let sleeping dogs lie.
Dad, you're scaring me.
Please don't judge us too harshly, Caroline. We love you. We always will. No matter what, you are our daughter.
I stared at him. Those were the most frightening words I'd heard yet. An hour later, my family was assembled in the living room. Allow me to make the introductions. You've already met my mother, Franny Cashin, attractive, lively, busy with the Flower Guild at church, and with bossing around her daughters-in-law and their ever-expanding broods of children. My father, Thomas Cashin. He's retired from practicing law, but he still consults occasionally and has developed a new, rather tiresome addiction to crosswords. He also runs 3 miles daily, which he claims is the best defense against my mother's onslaught of casseroles. My middle brother, Anthony. He's a lawyer, like Dad, the loudest and most obnoxious of us 3 kids. Now he was playing true to form, stomping around complaining that there was never beer in the house, and that this family powwow better not take longer than an hour, because he had dinner reservations at Russica at 8. And did we know how hard those were to get? As usual, my oldest brother, Martin, told him to shut up. Martin works in finance, real estate investment banking. He has repeatedly tried to explain what he does, but my eyes always glaze over when he launches into the benefits of maximizing liquidity through joint venture recapitalization and tax syndication equity. Are you still speaking English? I want to ask. A similarly glazed expression creeps over his face when I prattle on about how you can't read Balzac without applying Roland Barthes' semiotic code and accepting the plurality of the text. It's safe to say we have different interests. Fortunately, Martin and I really like each other. Now he plunked himself down next to me on the sofa.
Sis, you okay? You look like hell.
Martin, please, my mother said.
Fine, but seriously, what's up? Why the sudden summit? And why isn't Sis talking?
I stared pointedly at my father, waiting for him to speak. He cleared his throat.
Your sister got some news today.
Dad's voice was low, soothing, the voice he must have cultivated to command respect in the courtroom. I rarely heard him use it at home.
It's news she wasn't expecting, and that, frankly, your mother and I weren't expecting, and it leads to some questions and to a conversation best had as a family.
My mother nodded. Martin leaned forward, frowning. Even Tony stopped pacing and sat down.
Caroline got an X-ray today, and it revealed...
Dad patted his neck.
It revealed right here.
It revealed this, I snapped, and held my phone out to Martin. He examined the photo, used his fingers to zoom in and out a few times.
What is it?
My neck. He drew the screen closer to his face and squinted.
Your neck.
Tony leaned over and grabbed the phone.
But what's that?
He pointed toward the lower left corner of the screen. That would appear to be a bullet. Both my brothers looked up at me as if I were insane. Dad attempted to regain control of the conversation.
It is a bullet.
He swooped down and took the phone.
And I'm sorry. We are so sorry.
He gestured at my mom.
That you're finding out this way. We didn't know it was there. But we did know.
He took a deep breath.
We did know that you were shot when you were 3 years old.
Silence. Then Tony spoke.
Where? How?
My mother crossed the room, knelt in front of me, and took my hands. Before you came to us, before you came to be our beautiful angel girl. A tear slid down her cheek. I still didn't understand. Before I came to you? What are you talking about, before I came to you? Dad said when I was 3, I'd been here for 3 years.
Oh.
Martin exhaled the word slowly.
Was that why, Mom?
She ignored him, kept her eyes fixed on mine. We adopted you, Caroline. Your parents had died. We promised to love you and raise you as our own, and we have. We do. She squeezed my hands tightly. You'll have so many questions, I know. We'll do our best to answer them, but you need to understand. Within this room, within our family, nothing changes. Nothing. You are our daughter. You are their sister. Period. She shot my brothers a fierce look that meant, say something. Martin cleared his throat and shifted awkwardly on the sofa to face me.
Right. Absolutely. Nothing changes.
He glanced at Tony for support.
Sure. Right.
Tony sat blinking incredulously.
I haven't thought about all this in ages, to be honest. We were so little when you came. But, Mom and Dad, I have to say, this is a hell of a way to break it to Sis.
You knew? I stared at him. And you? I turned to Martin. Of course they had. I quickly did the math. Tony would have been 7, Martin already 9 when I arrived. Does it sound strange to say that at that precise moment this felt like the more painful betrayal? Not the shock of learning at 37 that I was adopted, that I was not and never had been who I'd thought I was, but that my brothers had known and kept it from me. They had kept a secret from me. Kept it so long they had nearly forgotten it themselves. Then again, Jesus, they were not really my brothers. I began to shake. My father reached for me. But I was lurching backward, scrambling over the top of the sofa, then running, desperate to get out of that room. I spent the next 2 hours locked in my old bathroom. I threw up, then sat shivering on the edge of the bathtub, a towel wrapped around my shoulders. From downstairs, I could hear voices, footsteps as people moved from room to room. I imagined my mother crying and my brothers calling home to their wives, explaining that a family crisis was underway and they would be late. Actually, that was an interesting point. Did their wives know about my history? Did everyone in this family know except me? I searched my memory. Nothing stood out. My childhood had felt normal, or as normal as I suppose anyone's ever does. I did think now to question the lack of baby pictures. Above the fireplace in the room I had just fled stood a row of silver frames, snapshots of family milestones. My parents' wedding picture, my brother's weddings, a triple frame to hold portraits of each of my brothers and me at our respective college graduations. On the left side of the mantle, Anthony and Martin were both displayed as plump, bald babies in christening gowns. My mother had brushed me off when I'd asked where my own baby photo was. Third child syndrome, I was too busy chasing your brothers to snap pictures of you. Now I felt like an idiot. Outside the bathroom door, someone moved, and then came a knock. Feel like talking? Martin. I frowned at the door. He stood there a minute, then tried again.
Sis?
The door handle rattled. The lock held. I heard him lean against the door and slide heavily down to sit on the floor of the upstairs landing.
I would be completely freaked out, too, if I were you. For what it's worth. This stuff coming out after all these years.
I said nothing, focused on radiating hostility through the door. Minutes passed.
I can sit here all night, you know. Always did like this landing. Mind you, I've got the whiskey on this side of the door. Hear that?
A clinking sound, ice in tumblers.
I'm betting you could use some right about now.
I began to weaken. Go away. I don't like whiskey.
Fine. Pretend it's champagne, or Bordeaux, or Sancerre, or something. Whatever you froggy Francophile types prefer to drink.
Please just go away. We sat a while, and then he said,
You know, I think the last time I remember you locking yourself in this bathroom to sulk, it was over that loser. What was his name? The chubby one?
Shut up, Martin.
No, come on. What was that? Your sophomore year? You were mad as hell because he'd cheated on you with some blonde. Josh something, wasn't it? Or Jack?
Jeff Benton.
I couldn't help myself. That's right. God, what a tool. What was the deal? He bailed on taking you to prom?
Yeah. A long pause. Yeah, he did. So you and Tony slashed his tires and spelled out the word dickwad in liquid fertilizer on his front lawn.
Well, that's what brothers are for.
Brothers. My stomach twisted. I pulled the towel tighter around myself.
Caroline, how about coming out now?
No.
In the narrow gap under the door, four fingertips appeared.
Don't, I warned.
The fingers wiggled farther in. Come on, before I get splinters all down the back of my knuckles.
Or I could just stomp on them.
Don't do that. I have to play squash this weekend.
This finally made me laugh. It came out more a croak than laughter, but it released something in me. Martin, I hesitated. What happened to my parents? My real parents.
Your birth parents, he corrected. I don't know. What I remember is being told we were getting a baby sister, and then one day there you were. Mom and Dad seemed happy about it, so we were too. I don't remember them ever using that word, adopted. It just seemed normal. Like, there had been two cash-in kids, and now there were three. Same as any other family when a third child comes along. Tony's right. We kind of forgot about it. The circumstances of how you arrived. Honestly, it's not like we've been sitting around for years gossiping behind your back.
I wasn't sure I believed that, but I relented. Stood up and opened the door. Martin pulled himself to his feet. I eyed my rail-thin, blonde, blue-eyed brother. You know, I look nothing like you.
This only just dawned on you?
No, but I mean, why didn't it ever strike me as odd?
I don't know. I have plenty of friends who look nothing like their siblings.
Right, but you and Tony look like twins. Aryan male models in a Brooks Brothers ad.
Oh, come on. Whereas I look like Salma Hayek if she were a few inches taller and had better cleavage. He snorted.
Don't think I'm letting you get away with that just because you're having an atrocious day. Your girl's got nothing on Salma's cleavage.
I punched his shoulder. It felt like a resumption of our usual banter, yet hollow, as if something precious had been lost. 5. The story gets worse from here. The blackest, most terrible bits did not emerge until nearly midnight. The five of us huddled back in the living room, my brothers installed protectively on either side of me on the sofa. My father and they had kicked back the bottle of whiskey and opened a second. Mom and I nursed mugs of tea. I figured I was already a wreck, my inhibitions plenty loosened as it was without adding whiskey to the equation. But there was no suitable state, drunk, sober, or anywhere in between, in which to receive the story that Dad proceeded to unleash. He told me that I had been born in Atlanta. My parents were a young married couple named Boone and Sadie Rawson Smith. Boone was a pilot for Delta. Sadie Rawson stayed home to raise me. They were college sweethearts. They had moved to Atlanta from Charlotte shortly before I was born. These details were included in the newspaper obituaries. They died together, shot cleanly and at close range. Boone through the head, Sadie Rawson through the heart. Murdered. My parents had been murdered in the autumn of 1979. They were both 26 years old. Their bodies were found in the kitchen of the white brick house they owned, on a pleasant street in a neighborhood called Buckhead. I was with them in the white brick house. I was shot, too. Shot in the neck and nearly died. When police kicked in the door, they found me blue-lipped and barely breathing on the kitchen floor. I was rushed to the hospital, given blood, stitched up. A miraculous recovery. But the case was never solved. The killer was never caught. Boone and Sadie Rawson Smith were buried, the house was sold, and I was sent to live in Washington.
That's pretty much all we know, my father concluded. When you came to us, the police investigation was still active. They wouldn't tell us much more than what was in the papers. And then time passed. Years passed, and it no longer seemed to matter so much.
He had been speaking with an air of grim determination. Now his voice softened.
You were so frightened when you came to us, Caroline. You wouldn't talk the first few weeks.
Our doctor was worried you might have suffered brain damage, whispered my mother. My mother... I suppose I'll have to start being more specific. My mother, meaning Franny Cashin, the woman in the room with me now. She shook her head. I knew he was wrong. I could look in your eyes and see that you were bright, really bright. You just needed time.
And we think that you might still have been in pain, Dad added.
Dad, by whom I mean Thomas Cashin, the dad I had grown up with. God, this was strange.
You had been badly wounded. They told us you'd had two surgeries, that you'd barely made it. But none of the medical records we received ever indicated that it might still be in your neck. We just...
He glanced helplessly at my mother.
We assumed that the bullet had been removed during one of those operations.
But I don't have a scar. It was the first time I'd spoken in nearly an hour. You did. You used to have a scar. My mother leaned forward and touched the base of my skull, half an inch to the left of the raised ridge of my spine. We could see it through your hair. But your hair grew in thicker every year.
and you got sick with chicken pox when you were six, and after that you had scars everywhere. I lost track of which were which. Then they all faded, even this one. For a moment, her finger pressed hard against my skull. Then she drew back and clasped her hands tightly on her lap. I turned to Dad. It's bizarre that the doctors didn't tell you they left the bullet in. I mean, wouldn't that be pertinent information to know about a child you were adopting?
It's outrageous, he said, both from a medical and a legal standpoint. But Caroline, you were under Georgia State Protective Custody. Your records, everything was sealed because of the criminal investigation. We were never allowed to meet your surgeons. Maybe they were calculating that the bullet didn't pose an urgent threat to your health by the time we were signing the adoption papers, so we didn't need to know. And after that, I don't know. Maybe it fell between the cracks when Georgia handed off your files to D.C.
I suppose we could have lodged an appeal to get your medical chart, said Mom, especially once the investigation quieted down. But Dad's right. Months went by, and then years, and you were happy here, thriving. You seemed fully healed. We weren't focused on digging around for old charts. It was too much to take in. I couldn't absorb it. Instead, I found myself latching onto small concrete details, such as my lack of a scar, or the name of a city. Atlanta, I heard myself say. I've never even been there. The name conjured up scenes from Gone with the Wind, Scarlett O'Hara flouncing around in a hoop skirt made from curtains. What else? Coca-Cola, Coke corporate headquarters were there. And the Olympics. Atlanta had hosted the Olympics back when I was in college. I remember the U.S. team dominating, Michael Johnson sprinting off with two golds. But I had no mental picture of the city. Apparently, though, I had indeed been to Atlanta. I had lived there for several years, and then forgotten every second of them. Martin seemed to read my thoughts.
You don't remember any of this, about the Smiths, or about coming to live with us?
No, I didn't.
It would be remarkable if she did, Dad put in. We did some research on this. Few children remember anything from before age four. If they do, it's often not a real memory, but a narrative they've created for themselves, from being shown photographs or told stories about a place or a person. And we deliberately never talked about anything that happened before Caroline came to us. We certainly didn't have photos to show.
On top of that, you'd been through such trauma.
Mom looked at me. Even an older child might have blocked it out. I nodded. That sounded reasonable. They both sounded just like their usual reasonable and reassuring selves, if you set aside the sheer insanity of this scene, the insanity of the entirely rewritten life history that I had been handed, a history that included a double homicide and two sets of parents and a bullet burrowed beneath my skin. Mom was right. I should have so many questions. But at that moment, they eluded me. My wrist ached more sharply than usual. All I wanted was to lie down and close my eyes. Dad. The word seemed to charge the room, like a lie that we were all waiting for someone to challenge. I forced myself to repeat it. Dad, would it be all right if I slept here tonight?
Well, of course, darling.
I walked over and kissed the top of his head. Then I kissed my mother and stretched my lips into a weak smile at my brothers. They would all start talking about me the minute I left the room. I didn't care. I turned and climbed the stairs to my old bedroom, cradling my wrist in my good hand. 6. Friday, October 11th, 2013. Remarkably, I slept. It is a small mercy that the body is capable of overriding the brain, forcing it to shut down in times of crisis. I slept for 5 obliterating hours before my eyes snapped open. I have never been one to wake up disoriented, and now, even in the pre-dawn darkness, I knew exactly where I was and why. Of the many questions that must have percolated while I was asleep, the one that woke me up was this. Was my name really Caroline? I crept downstairs. In the kitchen, looking as though they had not fared so well in the sleep department, stood my mother and Tony. Mom wore a blue flannel nightgown and robe. Tony had changed into stretched-out gray sweats emblazoned with the logo of his high school wrestling team. He must have found them folded in the back of a dresser drawer, forgotten for the 20-odd years since he'd last shambled in from practice and dropped them, stained and sweaty in a hamper for our mother to wash. They stopped talking when they saw me in the doorway. "What's my real name?" I asked without preamble. "Your real name," my mother repeated. "Is my name really Caroline?" "Oh, I see. Yes, yes, it is. But not Caroline Cashin." "No. Well, that is, of course it is. That's your legal name now. But you were born Caroline Smith. We decided to keep it. The name Caroline fit you. So graceful, and it sounds pretty with Cashin, and we thought it might be less disruptive for you emotionally to be called by the name that you were used to." I thought about this. "Do you have my birth certificate?" "Yes." She gestured vaguely toward the ceiling. "It's upstairs in the files. We had to have that and the adoption papers to get your first passport. You can see it if you want." "Sure. Yes." I chewed my lip. Tony stood and poured a cup of coffee. Then he excused himself. He needed to get home, get showered, say hi to the kids before work. He gave my shoulder a squeeze. "Hang in there. I'll call you later, okay?"
"Yep. Nice sweats, by the way."
He looked down. "High school glory days.
Good times. Go Bulldogs."
He looked unsure whether to rise to this. Then old habit kicked in, reflexes honed over a lifetime of sibling bickering. "I'll remind you that my senior year we nearly won the Mid-Atlantic Prep Championship Tournament."
"You nearly won?"
"That's right. You mean you came in 2nd? 3rd? A mere detail."
"Wow. No wonder the ladies couldn't resist."
He grinned and pulled me to him in a real hug. "My smart-ass sister. Sorry about all this. I'll call you."
He slammed the kitchen door shut.
My mother turned and started cracking eggs into a bowl. She rustled around in the fridge, pulled out bacon and bread. An uncomfortable silence grew between us.